And thank everybody for coming. We are going to start off with our informational hearing, and that is on freight rail, so I'll go ahead and open the informational hearing. And we have a special guest, Representative Susan Morgan, who has insight.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Susan Morgan. I'm a state representative from House District 2, which is parts of Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson counties. And I'm here today to thank the chair very much for bringing the rail issues onto the forefront of the agenda. In Southwest Oregon, we have a transportation work group that has been meeting for about 2 years that I chair, and it's a public-private partnership. Rep Gilman and Rep Buckley are both members of the work group, and this is a group that meets and talks about how to use transportation infrastructure investments to build a base under job creation and retention in the region. And one of the issues that we've run full force into is the impact of the closure of our local short line railroad on family wage industrial based jobs in the area. How do you do?
Hi there.
I would just reiterate to you that the short line railroads all over the state are very important to retaining the family wage, especially the resource-based jobs that makes things work in the rural areas of the state. Without our short line railroad, we have problems in all parts of Southwest Oregon getting goods to market, getting raw materials in. So I very much applaud the chair for bringing this issue to the forefront, and I look forward to observing the next session of the legislature, where I'm hoping that there is a comprehensive discussion around a state policy towards especially the short line railroads. That's a system that needs to be coordinated much better than it is, and there needs to be an overall plan for upgrades, and that is the way I think that we're going to create and retain family wage jobs in Oregon. So thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16, which is home to some short line railroads as well. I had really planned to just listen to this part of the presentation, but I appreciate the chair's courtesy in inviting me to make some comments. And I would like to lend bipartisan, bicameral support to the comments made by my esteemed colleague, Representative Morgan. These short line railroads are the catalyst to create new jobs in the districts where they reside, and they are the lifeline to bring goods and services out into, in some cases, a global marketplace. My short lines right now, both are in trouble. One of them extends from Portland up to Astoria. It was the line that carried very successfully for 3 years, the Lewis and Clark Explorer train that I think some of you may have ridden on. It now has suffered a breach by virtue of a dike failure, and we are struggling to get that repaired. I will say that ODOT Rail, under the leadership of Kelly Taylor, has been extraordinarily helpful. My other short line railroad, I'm sure that any of you that have subscribed to any newspaper anywhere in the state, you've seen on the front page, and that's the Port of Tillamook Bays Railroad that extends from Tillamook across the Coast Range and services markets, bringing finished goods out of Tillamook County and product back into Tillamook County. And that railroad right now is rendered completely non-functional by virtue of the devastating storms that racked Northwest Oregon in early December. So I, too, would like to thank the chair for her leadership on this issue, thank the committee for hearing this important subject matter, and to just add my whatever she said I agree comments about short lines. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these representatives?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to thank both of the witnesses for their relentless work on this issue, and particularly Representative Morgan for taking care of Southern Oregon and taking a lead, and I look forward to the continued work, and no matter what you evolve into in your next steps after the legislature.
Thank you.
We're going to interpret relentless as a term of praise and affection.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to go a little out of order on this and let Kelly Taylor kind of wrap up the conversation at the end. So, and I understand that Annette Price is going to be replaced by Lana Butterfield. And if Roger Martin wants to come up too.
Thank you.
You meant just for today, right, Madam Chair?
Just today. Yeah, and Dave Barrows, you want to come up at the same time here? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm here replacing Annette Price, who is the president of OROL. My name is Lana Butterfield, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rail Users League. I've given you a little history about OROL. I only want to read the first paragraph because that's our mission statement. The Oregon Rail Users League is an organization serving public and private interests that operate, utilize, and support railroads in the state of Oregon. OROL advocates for the rights and needs of railroads and their customers while encouraging economic growth within the state of Oregon. If you look down at the membership list, you'll see that we have Class 1s, Class 2s, the short lines, we have ports, we have shippers, we have engineering companies, just a whole very big umbrella discussion group. We meet quarterly. In addition to our members, we have a list of also some of the public interests. So we have about 150 people on our distribution list, including some legislators if you'd like to be on that. We believe that rail is extremely important to the economy of the state of Oregon. And all of the folks you have on your agenda are OROL members that will follow me.
Okay. Any questions? Go ahead.
Welcome. Madam Chair, my name is Roger Martin. I'm one of the contract lobbyists along with Cindy Robert for the Union Pacific Railroad in Oregon. The sheet in front of you that are just being passed out is actually testimony prepared for Brock Nelson, and I'm delivering it because Brock Nelson is the Union Pacific's new Director of Public Affairs for Oregon and Washington. He's moving here from California, where he's been headquartered for a number of years, and he currently, as we speak, is looking for a house with his wife, who's up visiting this weekend. And so he would love to be here, and he will be down. And some of you met him already. More of you will in the future. He's very enthusiastic about being the UP's guy in Oregon and Washington. I'll just paraphrase some of the words here. The second paragraph speaks about safety of our employees, neighbors, and the communities through which we operate. Railroads are unique, and I did not learn this until a few years ago when I went to my first railroad meeting, but every railroad meeting I have been to starts off with the person in charge saying, the escape route in case of fire is this way. The property has on it respiratory devices. Several of us are trained in CPR. They go through every meeting is this way. It's very interesting because the railroads have taken on the issue of safety to the fullest extent, because railroads can and have been dangerous. We have too many railroad crossings in Oregon. The public officials and railroads would like to find a way to get rid of many of those, but we're very safety conscious. It is important to know that the Union Pacific has reorganized, and the reason Brock Nelson is here is that they've totally reorganized their outreach, public relations, public affairs departments all over the country, and they are locating in the 23 states where we operate people like Brock to be closer, to put a face on their presence in the community, try to communicate better. The Union Pacific is the largest railroad in Oregon. It's one of the largest in the world. It has 32,000 miles of track in 23 western states. It operates at any given time, 365 days of the year. Over 2,000 freight trains are moving somewhere in the western part of the United States. We have 50,000 employees, 2,000 of whom work in Oregon. And we have 8,500 locomotives, and that's an issue that comes up occasionally when you start talking about things like biodiesel. We always have to raise our hand and say, remember, locomotives are like elephants. We keep them for 35 or 40 years. We have to be very careful what we burn in them, and so be conscious that we have specifications for our engines that may be greater than other kinds of diesel engines. The important thing I do want to talk about, in the past year, we spent over $3 billion on the system in investments, and this year we will spend over $3 billion again. And that is 20% of the gross revenue of the railroad. I want to underline that, 20% of the gross revenue of the railroad. No other industry in this country invests as much in capital as the railroads do. It is three or four times what any other industry that you could compare it to is. We're constantly doing that investment, and we're doing it here in the Oregon. In Oregon, since 2003, we spent over $330 million in Oregon. About a little less than half of that's been just on the I-5 corridor. And we are investing, that's all private money, and we're investing to the limit. And I bring that up because before the U.S. Congress has been legislation to give an additional tax incentive for greater investment. It didn't get considered by the last session. This committee and its predecessors have considered memorials to Congress urging them to do that because we, all the railroads, are prevented from investing any greater amount than that by Wall Street. You simply can't invest. Wall Street and the stock exchange will not support companies that invest in excess of the 20%. That's the maximum we can go to. Now, if the federal government allowed a tax treatment for only for capital expenditures, both the short lines and the private and the class ones could invest more than they are presently investing. It's something that ought to be considered. You should know, and many of you may have read, there was a recent mudslide in January on the Willamette Pass that has closed our main line. And it came at absolutely the worst weather conditions of any kind. When we started to work on that line, we had snow 10 to 12 feet deep, and it kept building up. There are pictures from the Register Guard and from our own company of snow at one day at 4 feet more the next day. Trying to repair that line has been a monumental task. It will cost, I don't know how many tens of millions of dollars, that no figure is in yet, and we probably will not have it reopened until sometime in late March, and that is at breakneck speed. The slide was unbelievable, and I don't have all the details, but it's very long, and it took out huge sections of the entire line that has to be rebuilt in the worst weather conditions. We are diverting five trains that we ordinarily have 15 freights on that line per day. Five of those are going over the Burlington Northern Santa Fe BNSF line through Bend down the Deschutes River and then down the Columbia to Portland. 10 of those trains are going from the Bay Area or Sacramento area of California to Salt Lake and then back down on our east-west line down the Columbia River to get them serviced. So we've overloaded the Columbia River line in order to serve and to keep that freight moving, but it's extremely important. You probably have heard, and you will hear, that railroads are two to four times more fuel efficient than other forms of transportation, i.e. trucks, because one ton of freight can go 780 miles on a gallon of fuel on a railroad. And when you're using a fully loaded train, we're taking about 280 trucks off the highway system. And we are well aware that ODOT wants very much to have us do as much or more of that as possible to try to help the congestion along the line. Now, just from a brief background, one of the things I think that this committee and the Senate committee, the Senate Transportation Committee, should do, and we've had conversations with both your chair and with Senator Metzger, is spend more time really studying the rail system, which you want to do. In this state, the first transportation was either by horseback on trails that the Native Americans had used for centuries or down the Columbia River. The next form of transportation was the rail system, built during and after the Civil War at private expense, except for, and you don't have to tell me, land grants were used to try to encourage the development of the West, but the West was developed by the railroads. And at one time, 100 years ago, rail served almost every community in this state. Starting in the 1920s, we started taking up some of the shorter lines, and a tremendous number of lines were taken out, and those that still remain serving some of our smaller communities are part of the short line system. But rail goes in just certain areas. The Union Pacific's line is east-west paralleling Highway 84 and north-south paralleling both I-5 and on the east side on Highway 97. We can And the role of major rail has changed. We are basically interstate carriers, and we work with the short lines. Over 50% of our freight comes from the short lines that you've heard about, and we fully understand that their rail systems desperately need assistance. But there were a lot of reasons, and I'm a history major, so I tend to want to give you a little history on it. Starting first with our highway system that developed in the early part of the last century, and then tremendously accented by the interstate freeway system that was built in the 1950s and 60s, much freight shifted from rail to highways. And I think all of us really need to understand that highway construction was greatly subsidized by the governments of our nation and our state. And that coincided with the huge development of an air industry, which if you look at it, we have airlines today, and I represent one of them, built on airports built in the Second World War by our Defense Department, followed by, and most of those airplanes were built by Boeing, the huge airliners, and when the war was over, they converted B-29s into 707s, and we developed a huge airline industry, carries freight, that was also subsidized. And I bring that up because the rail system is, for the most part, totally privately financed and built, and we need you to recognize that. We need your help in trying to encourage the federal government to do more about encouraging us or making us able to spend more of our money in the investment. Eventually in this state, we're going to probably have to double track a lot more than we are currently. If you went to the southwest part of the United States, the corridor from Los Angeles east to the Mississippi River is being double tracked by both the BNSF and the Union Pacific because it's carrying huge amounts of freight out of the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. And we need eventually to have that same kind of system to carry more freight on our system. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee.
Dave, we'll let you go, and then we'll pepper you, I guess.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Barrows. I'm here today representing BNSF Railway, formerly known as Burlington Northern Santa Fe. We are the other Class 1 in Washington. We're the largest Class 1 railroad. Here we are the secondary Class 1 railroad. The Union Pacific's larger in Oregon than we are. And part of that is because many of you, I'm sure, are aware that for our north-south traffic, our east-west traffic goes out of Seattle, basically, or Tacoma, and goes straight east. It stays in Washington, goes into upper Idaho, and then to Montana. Our north-south comes down from Seattle area, Tacoma, turns left at Vancouver and goes along the north side of the Columbia River till it gets about 5 miles from the Deschutes River. And many of you that have driven I-84 have seen a railroad bridge there. That's our bridge going across the Columbia. We parallel Union Pacific for about 3 miles, and then we turn and go up the Deschutes, and they continue east. And that then we're heading south. And as Roger pointed out, there's value in having these two separate lines because of the slide situation they had. We were able to pitch in a bit, and they would do the same for us. And the point there is that Class 1s work well together. But I also want to make the point that all of us need to work closely together, and that's the Class 1s, the short lines, the truckers, because we're all part of a system. Trailers happen to be our largest single item that we carry on the Burlington Northern Santa Fe nationally, meaning the West. And that takes a lot of trucks off the highway, which is, I think we'd all agree, a good way to move freight. As Rogers pointed out, it's much cheaper, it's more environmentally friendly, and then the trailers come off the flatbed and are attached to a tractor, meaning what we all just call a truck, and it's moved then directly to its destination. We've done a good job in this state, in terms of having good conversations about rail movement and freight movement altogether. There's a freight advisory committee that ODOT manages. Kelly's involved in that, but it involves all the pieces of freight movement. We're estimated the rail traffic in this country is estimated to move from 1.6 trillion ton miles in back in 2004 to 2.4 trillion ton miles in 2030. We can't do it on the current system. Impossible. And one of the difficulties that railroads have is you build a railroad, and then if somebody decides they really don't need that, you waste a lot of money. And that's one of the difficulties that the people who make capital decisions in railroads face all the time. Rail has been traditionally kind of a commodity-driven form of transportation. We've been very heavy on what are called unit trains, primarily coal. Has been traditionally kind of 40% of the rail's business. Trains that carry nothing but automobiles, trains that carry nothing but wheat, unit trains. We're seeing less and less of that. More are now containers, more are now tractor trailers, and more are in containers, items coming out of Asia. And as Roger pointed out, the huge tie-up of freight in the Los Angeles Long Beach area is just almost indescribable. Ships have to wait out at anchor for a while to get into a berth to get offload, and then the trains just run kind of almost 24 hours a day. It's pretty incredible. Other ports are going to benefit from this mess down in, actually in L.A., and Portland has been named as one of those ports that's going to hopefully help with alleviation of this congestion. So that's another reason we want to continue to have these conversations. You all have done a terrific job. Connect Oregon was extremely helpful. Connect Oregon 2 is on the verge of awarding projects that are going to really help the worst congestion spot we have in Oregon, which is called the Port of Portland Triangle. And that is a real bottleneck that needs to be dealt with. Rogers pointed out the environmental, and I guess I have too, the environmental efficiencies that can be developed through rail, and that's all good. So it is imperative that we can, all of us, you and your roles, us and our roles, the shippers, all of us work together as closely and as dedicatedly as we can to move this conversation forward, because it's an ongoing huge need, and none of us can solve it by ourselves. Thank you very much.
Representative Tomei, yes, I do. Thank you so much. Thank you for your testimony today, and I think you're going to, of course, you'd find that this committee is very supportive of rail traffic. I have a couple of questions. One of them, I think, is for you, Roger. You mentioned the capital improvement of 20% of gross revenue in the last couple of years. I'm wondering, traditionally, has that been the case, or is the situation sort of deferred maintenance, and now you're trying to catch up?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, the answer to that would be probably it has increased, the investment has increased since railroads became more profitable. Going back 30 years, in the early 1980s, railroads were regulated, totally regulated by the federal government, and all of them were on the brink, either in bankruptcy or on the brink of bankruptcy, and that's when the rail system just went to pot. We didn't do the maintenance we should have. So some of that is a catch-up, but for the last decade and a half, there's been significant in the range of 20% of gross revenues going on all the time. Much of that is expansion. And what Dave mentioned, incidentally, I forgot to say in my testimony, one way to really find out about the triangle he's talking about and the whole bottlenecks that exist in the Portland area would be to go on a tour, which I highly recommend, that the Port of Portland can put on for you, because we intersect both railroads on port property. And railroads and ports are kind of things you don't see from the freeway. You got to go there to see what's going on. And I would, Brock Nelson, when he first came to Portland, went on one of these tours, and I went along, Cindy and I were able to go. It's a real eye-opener. If you really want to understand the rail system in the metropolitan area and the rest of the state, let's go on a tour like that, which we could do when the weather gets nicer and you're not in session. I think it would be something that both transportation committees ought to do jointly.
Have a follow-up?
Yes.
Could you talk some about your relationship with Amtrak? I know Kelly will be talking about that more, but is it true, as I remember, that freight rail takes precedence over passenger rail? That's not
no,
okay. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, it's the other way around. It's one of the aspects of the Amtrak law that the freight train has to come off and get on a siding and wait for the Amtrak train to go by. It doesn't always work perfectly, as we know, and as a result, if it's rare that the train going from Southern California, the Coast Starlight, from Southern California doesn't arrive from Seattle on time very often. And part of that, frankly, is the conflict between the freight line and the passenger lines. That's just the ones that come from Eugene, the Cascade trains that run from Eugene to Portland to Seattle tend to be better in their on-time records. But it is a little bit of a conflict, but the Amtrak does have precedent over the freight.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a concern with the two large railroads. They tend to not care if they have an individual customer, it seems like, anymore, unless they've got a unit train. If you've got 100 cars, we'll do business with you. If you've got one car, we may not do business with you. That's one of the places the short lines come in. The short lines are the mechanism to get that one car into a train. But my impression is that you will not allow a short line engine out on your rail to make switching. And it seems to me that some of those companies that are on the main line and historically were picked up but are not now could be served if you allow a short line engine out there.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, there's truth to what you're saying. Although it is not the intention, our company spends a lot of time with mills in your area that are the backbone of freight coming out of Southern Oregon, and we attempt to accommodate. We attempt to work with the short lines. There are agreements where short lines can, in places, operate on our system. But I'd rather not try to answer that question because I'm not an operating guy, and I misspeak myself if I tried to give you any details on that. Just as an example, the lumber industry about 4 years ago were all over us for not having sufficient cars. And Union Pacific bought 3,500 centerboard. Those are the cars that have a big steel plate in the middle, and you load plywood or lumber on either side of them. You know where most of them are now? In storage, because the lumber business went into decline and we don't have the demand. The customer relations, our freight people, I'm sure the BNSF is the same way, are constantly working with the people, our shippers, to try to accommodate where they can. But the days when a farmer, and we get in trouble with the Agriculture Committee, could call up and say, the potato crop's coming in sometime in late August, early September, we'd like 12 cars on the siding, and sit them there for a week or two until we fill them, those days are probably gone, and that's the rub we get into. But there's more that can be done, I'm sure, and if we could build the short lines to the strength that we would all like to see them in, that those kind of your customers you're talking about would be better served.
Any other questions? Seeing none.
Well, just probably more of a comment, although if you have any suggestions. We had a hearing last session in 09 on rail, and I think that and probably the class ones were feeling a little sideswiped in that particular case because we had a business community out there that was very unhappy with the service they're getting just in general, and probably not even to you totally at fault, but just in the whole system, because we know we can move rail cheaper and more efficiently than we can on the roads, and most of us would really like to see those trucks off the road, as many of them as we could onto rail, but we seem to have some roadblocks, and I don't know if you have any suggestions or you, at some point you can help us out in what you think we really can do. And I know we're trying with the Connect Oregon process to put some money in, but I think we're the weather and age is opening up more holes than we're able to fill. So we need to do something, and I don't know if you would like to help us or offer suggestions or.
Well, I'll take one shot at it, and then Lana or Roger obviously jump in. One of the things, and this speaks also to Representative Gilman's question, I think, one of the things that is helpful to the Class 1s is the creation of staging areas. As an example, we have, the NSF Railway has a very large container staging area on Northwest Eon in the industrial area of Portland. And trucks are coming there all hours of the day and night, 7 days a week, with containers from manufacturers, or empty containers to go back someplace, and they are put on trains that are built to take containers. That is much more efficient, even with its problems, and it has some, than it is for the major for a long train to stop every 2 miles to pick up a container. So they have to be staged. I think I meant to talk to Doug more about this, but I think out of Connect Oregon, there was a staging area built in Prineville to try to pull some manufacturing materials together in one place, and then it makes it doable to stop and add those cars on. But it is a very inefficient way to, quote, run the railroad. Obviously, to stop and pick up a car. You've got a ton of cars, in effect, sitting, not moving a foot, while you move one car on. And it's a very difficult situation for us. It obviously causes great problems for other people. But one of the reasons that we've been so aggressive in trying to get the trailers from tractor-trailer trucks onto the flatbeds is for this very reason. That's a real efficient way to move freight. Is you get 3 or 4 truckloads of something from this manufacturer, you put them on a flatbed and take them 2,000 miles to the east, and then offload them and have a trailer hook them up and haul them to wherever they're supposed to be hauled. That's a whole lot better than trying to haul those 5 trucks all the way across the mountains on the interstate highway system. And obviously you've heard many hours of testimony about the problems the trucking industry has relative to finding drivers, long-haul drivers especially, and all those things. So that's why all of us working together, all of us being you, us, the shorelines, the truckers, everybody working together is the only way we're going to really address this, all of this.
Just to follow up, that's why we all enthusiastically endorse our rule. It's an opportunity for us to get together with representatives of the trucking industry, of the shipping industry, and talk about some of these problems. Railroads face difficult problems. Representative Tomei's district, I believe, includes Brooklyn Yards, or your district, no, maybe it's just north of you, but the Brooklyn Yards is one of the old areas for exactly what Dave just said, and we've been under a constraint from some corridor neighborhood association agreement to not extend our train out along McLaughlin Boulevard. We got to try to stay within it. And every once in a while, when you're dealing with trains that are 100 cars long, it's difficult not to use some of it because the yard was never designed for trains of that length. And we're constantly in an argument with the city of Portland, trying to obey what the law is and try to work with the neighborhood. If you remember, in the Portland area, we had spurs running all over the industrial areas of Portland in the south west, I mean southeast, there used to be spurs going everywhere, all over where the Pearl District is now, used to be railroad sidings, and everybody had these individual cars. What Dave described for you is exactly what's happened. That's been consolidated into big staging areas. And that will end up inevitably irritating somebody who for 40 years got their car load every 3 months delivered to their warehouse door. It's not the same anymore, and it's those kind of things that gets us in trouble. And I do remember that hearing. In the defense of the railroad, you usually are not going to get a shipper that's satisfied coming to testify to this committee, but you are a forum. You are a delightful forum for somebody to come in, and let me tell you what's wrong with that railroad.
Thank you.
Just very quickly, since I put the agenda together, O'Rourke hasn't met this year yet, but we will again in April, and we'll put this on the agenda, your question.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity, Madam.
My agenda. Oh, it's right here. Bruce Carswell, Paul Langner, and Mike Wendell. You guys all want to come up?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank. My name is Bruce Carswell. I'm president of the Portland and Western Railroad. Had an opportunity to testify in front of some of you just here a few weeks ago, and as a result, I decided not to bore you with a lot of the same details and just make a couple of comments emphasizing points from that and then be ready for any questions. As a representative of short line and regional railroads in Oregon, I would just like to say that the comments that preceded mine are straight to the point. The over 50% of the rail network in Oregon is now owned by short line railroads, and short line railroads, by their very formation and definition, usually operate lines that are of lighter traffic density and oftentimes did not get maintenance over the years to the level that we would all probably like to have seen. Those sorts of issues are definitely at the heart of the problems we've seen with the Coos Bay line, the line over Siskiyou, our line down to Monroe and Dawson, and also the Port of Tillamook Bay. Part of the challenges, as some of my esteemed colleagues stated earlier, are really get back to the ancient history of, if you will, of the transportation system around this part of the country. The whole issue of modal equity has meant that a lot of that traditional traffic vacated the railway a number of years in the past, and what we've been living off since then, has been essentially just those customers that didn't have the ability to do economically some of the consolidation that Roger was describing. That doesn't mean that we should forsake those customers, because I think they have a role to play, they have a need, and I think in the future there's going to be more of those customers out there. Probably one of the things we're going to have to look at is, do we need now take these big mega terminals that we have in urban areas like Portland and start to consolidate and build smaller ones further out into the country and into the rural areas, so that everybody can get economic access to rail transportation and be able to support the network. By the nature of a Portland or of a private rail network, the decisions on where the maintenance dollars go and expansion dollars as well are all made on basis of business decision, and ultimately that's led to some of the problems that we've seen here. The cold hard light of day spreadsheet says that if you make X amount of dollars, you can't spend X over X amount of dollars and stay in business very long. So that's resulted in a situation as I've described. Going forward, forward, you know, the state may very well, along with other entities, decide that's not a very good model, because ultimately some of these rail lines have strategic value beyond what a private entity can make a case for, you know, in a business environment, whether that be commuter rail potential in the future or strategic economic development that may not be ready to happen today, but it's going to happen sometime soon. You know, those sorts of things ultimately need to play into some sort of a process to make a decision. Is it better to keep that rail line around for now in whatever mechanism, whether it's public-private partnership or rail banking or whatever. But ultimately, you know, that dialogue needs to happen to make sure that we don't lose portions of the network that are of dire importance, because once it's gone, it's going to be very hard to recreate. With that, I'll turn it over to my esteemed colleague next to me.
Thank you much, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, thank you for letting me, allowing us to be here. My name is Paul Langer. I represent Caton Brothers Land and Timber Company. We're a short line user. We move logs by rail, timber products, and we're in Oregon. We're darn glad to be doing it. In 2000, with the Portland and Western Railroad, we moved 700 rail cars. It was a novel opportunity. We loaded up in Rainier, Oregon. We sent those rail cars down to the southern end of the valley and down to Roseburg area. Pretty neat little program. We found out quickly one rail car moves about 3.5 to 3.8 truckloads of logs. Last year we moved over 10,000 rail cars. We took about 40,000 truckloads off the interstate one way, round trip. It's 80,000 truckloads that did not go through downtown Portland, the Terwilliger curves, the traffic project here in Salem. All those logs just went right on by and nobody saw it, and that's a good thing for us. It's a great market for us. We move both ways. Right now we're sitting our little wood basket up in northwest Oregon. We're able to feed the mills down in the valley and down to Roseburg, Cottage Grove, Philomath, Roseburg products. And with the change of the dollar and downturn of our market, we're able to capitalize on that, taking the export wood that's coming out of private timberlands in the southern part of the state, moving them up to our facility in Rainier, where it's a little shuttle move across the dock to the export docks in Longview. It's a great program. We're doing good. Say we're taking lots of trucks off the road. And we'd like to do more. Unfortunately for us, just weeks before we could set up a program out of Coos Bay with lumber, we're now shipping lumber from Oregon to Hawaii. The market, the corporate railroad went down, which now unfortunately has added 60 trucks a day or 60 trucks a week that now drive from Coos Bay up to Rainier. It's unfortunate, but if that line comes back, there'll be more business for us and we'd like to use it. Our offer for solution is the 286 compliance. I know you're aware of it. If we can get those rail lines up to 286-pound capacity, it adds capacity, it adds reliability and velocity. And those are absolutely critical to sit there and make rail viable for us. The other one is stacking capacity. Bruce's guys have done a heck of a job out there, and you heard the Class 1s talk about it too. It's time to start building sidings and more capacity out here, just because the fact that we cannot send two or three cars at a time, but logs and 2x4s don't care when they get to the market. And if we can build up 40 or 50 of them, then we can be competitive. The other one are some small bottlenecks. Connect Oregon and Connect Oregon 2 have been great solutions for it. These are little opportunities where the railroads have to jump out, as the vice chair said, where they have to jump out on the Class 1 to run a half mile up and down the track. If we can get around some of those situations, it's going to tremendously increase velocity and capacity for us, because they just don't have to get out there. One thing that people have talked about is reloads, and I'm here to tell you that reloads are not an answer. You've got to initiate that rail as close to the product as you can. We've looked at trying with the Coos Bay wood coming up to Rainier. We've looked at a reload in the Eugene area. The problem is you got to pay to someone to take it off the truck, and you got to pay to reload it back on the rail. And once it's on that truck, it's just as cheap to keep it on the truck. That's an unfortunate fact. There's a short window to build capacity. Right now, the Class 1s are... we've got some extra room right now because the lumber market's down. Now is the time for us, I think, to get our little nose inside the tent and start building other capacity to get other products out. And when the lumber comes back, hopefully they'll let us get in there with it. Thank you for an opportunity to talk to them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair of Committee. Just for the record, is there a way we could have this meeting outside? Because it's really nice.
No.
Not going to happen, is it? All right. Just for the record, my name is Mike Wendell. I'm the mayor of the city of Prineville. The city of Prineville is the current owner of the oldest freight-moving railroad in the nation. I mean, we're very proud of the railroad that we have. We've been moving rail longer than I've been around, longer than quite a few people have been around. The railroad was started in 1918. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we moved in the neighborhood of around 10,000 cars per year. 2004, we moved a total of 87 cars. It's quite a change for our community. Today, we're back up to around 1,800 to 2,000. This all started as around about 2005, when I was first elected to the council as the mayor. It was a tough decision for the community at that time to decide whether we were going to continue to own this rail or whether we were going to abandon the rail. So we went out to the community and said, what do you want to do? The community at that time said, we want you to try and make it, and if you can't make it, we'll close the thing down. So since then, we've been very successful in trying to make it work. We brought on, I have Dale Keller with me today to help answer any technical questions. That's his realm, and that's what he does. Our rail manager, we have Dan Lovelady, can't be with us. Apparently, the shot that he got for the flu didn't work either, so along with a lot of other people. So he's at home with the flu right now. So since one of the things that we realized in 2005 is what we need to do is we need to bring on people that can really make this thing work. If we're gonna try it as hard as we can. So we brought these folks on to help us try and make the railroad work. So far, we have been successful. As you see here, I have some talking points for you. It hasn't been without struggle. We've had to work through some things, but I think we're getting there one way or another. We've had some issues here and there with Class 1s. They've been very supportive of us, and we appreciate that, but we look forward to moving to the next step. And our region, Central Oregon, is one of the fastest-growing regions in the state. There's a huge need for rail, and we want to be able to accommodate that. The Class 1s, Burlington Northers and UP, had said earlier that it's very tough for them to stop and pick up one car. We believe that we fit that ability with our Prineville Freight Depot, which thank you for Connect Oregon. It has been a great success for us, and even though our facility is over the period of a couple Connect Oregons, it will continue to be a big success for us. So we appreciate that. But we do see that the continued need for Connect Oregon for us to finalize our facility. We would hate to get three-quarters of the way down the road and then be short funding to finish our facility, and then it just sort of sits there. It would be very tough for us to do that. So we always look forward to continuing with Connect Oregon. With that, I think if you wouldn't mind, if you would allow, Dale Keller has a few comments he'd like to make. Would that be okay, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Dale Keller. I'm the business development manager for the City of Prineville Railway and the Prineville Freight Depot, which is our transload facility. Dan Lovelady, our GM, and I sat down last Friday and took a quick look at, and of course we titled it, What's Wrong with Rail Service in Oregon? And you can paint that with a very broad brush, or you can look at it in a manner of which we've been fortunate enough to be able to say, maybe there's not so much wrong. It's how we manage the assets that we have, the partnerships that are available, and how we bring all the players to the table and figure out a way to deal with the lack of infrastructure, with the new business model for the Class 1s, with the necessary backup roles that the short lines can play, and basically bring it together as more of a partnership. Because most certainly your short line railroads, by and large, are cast-offs from back when in the 70s there were 60-odd class ones. Now there's six or seven. You've got all these short lines, as the gentleman here said, they're under-maintained. They aren't 286K compliant. They're lightweight. We're lucky. We got a 20-mile railroad. It's 286K. And by the way, we actually have three locomotives and a steam engine. But no, anyway, it's one of those things where, you know, it's obvious that with the lack of infrastructure, if you go to Europe, you look at, you know, they're double track, triple track. They've got all these things in place. And again, they view transportation in a different way than we have in the United States. But again, it's obvious that if you're looking at 3.25 truckloads to 3.5 truckloads will go on a rail car, and you get out there 600-700 miles and more, and your freight rates start to diminish, it takes, particularly in Central Oregon, for your small businesses that are growing in a limited footprint, they can buy in volume, they get the benefits of shipping in volume, and overall it makes them more competitive. Again, their product then, you know, it's going to be more competitive in the regional market, national market, and international market. And you get that type of thing going, that's when you create the family wage earner jobs. And it's basically, in a nutshell, it's a win-win if we can take this monster, and particularly since deregulation and the fact that, you know, everybody understands that publicly traded companies have to make money, because if they don't, it doesn't work. But again, I think it's a, again, we would call for a large partnership. Again, from our standpoint, we're extremely appreciative of the Connect Oregon programs. It's done more than we can imagine as far as allowing us to build our warehousing facilities. We have a 32-acre site that was formerly a sawmill. We have existing buildings. We're building new buildings. We're adding. We're bringing in, even during an economic downturn, we're actually bringing in customers. You know, it's pretty sweet. But again, I would argue that education is a big thing. Particularly in the smaller rural areas where once upon a time they did have a lot of rail service. It moved away. And to take and go out and talk to customers as I do, it's very difficult to change their mindset. I'll order a truck. Yeah, but that truck is going to take this much money, this much time, and look how much more product you can get for the same price. All these things, they fall in. And I think it's a big thing. It's not a singular solution. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. I know I learned a lot of new phrases today that I hadn't heard before.
Me too.
I have them all written down here.
And when was it, Madam Chair, that we were in Prineville? Was that, a year and a half, 2 years ago, that we visited some of the...
Is that when you were chair? Did we go to Prineville?
Yeah, that was very interesting.
So, Kelly Taylor, and you can pull all the loose ends together and tell us how we're going to fix it, right?
You bet.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am Kelly Tater. I'm with the ODOT Rail Division. And what I wanted to do today to share with you is an assessment that I did in December with my staff. We did this high-level assessment of the short line specifically. There's just been a number of issues that have come up, as you've heard, you know, the Corp line, Portland, Port Nisomic Bay, et cetera, et cetera. And both my director and the governor said, you know, we really need a snapshot of what the railroads look like right now, some way for us to gauge how their business viability is or isn't. And so what you have before you is that assessment. And it takes in different components of each system. For example, the number of miles that they're maintaining and running, revenue that comes in an annual, carloads, average per mile, number of bridges and tunnels that they have on their system, because those are obviously expensive items. So I want to walk you through what's in here and leave you with that. It's small print. It's an eye chart. You know, some hangover from my DMV days. But what I wanted to tell you is it's true that the short lines have inherited the redundant lines that were spun off by the Class 1s, in which maintenance much of the time was deferred. So what they're getting is probably likely in poor condition since the 1980s, when the short lines were mostly evolving and becoming. And these folks were entrepreneurial spirit. They wanted to take on and try to run a railroad. But if they don't have enough business, if they don't have enough carloads, They're not going to have enough revenue to do both operations and maintenance. And operations is running it, the personnel and the fuel and running the locomotives and the cars up and down the line and all the people that are associated with that. But maintenance is what you put back into the line to not just keep it going, but to improve it. And they've got an older system, and so we're going to talk about that. So what I've got here is, so what I'm trying to say is, without the revenue, it's just a matter of time before they deplete the residual value, and that's what's happening. They're actually eating up the residual value left in their lines that they inherited. And this isn't just happening in Oregon. This is happening across the country. I hear from my counterparts in other states, their short lines are in trouble too. And the issue of unit trains versus loose carloads, the picking up the 1 to 20 to 30 carloads, that's happening across the country too. We are seeing a shift in business models across the country because it is more efficient to do the staging and to pick up a long bunch of cars already put together and hook and haul, as they would say, across the country. It is more efficient. You can use the same a small amount of crew to do that versus stopping and starting. It's much like we use our interstate highway system versus our side roads and our county roads. It's the very same idea. And you want to do access management on the railroad, not have a bunch of driveways all hooked up to your interstate. It's the same idea that you're familiar with in roads, only it happens on the railroad system too. So what you're seeing happening in Oregon is happening across the country. It isn't just here. So on page 2, one of the things that I have in here is from a 1993 pamphlet before he started Small Railroad, is annual carloads per mile being predictors of viability. And this is reflected on the chart that's attached, and we'll get to that. But it shows you, depending on how many carloads per mile you handle, whether or not you're probably going to make it. And when you get to the chart that we're going to get to in the back, you'll see that a lot of our railroads do not have enough carloads to make it. So it's just a matter of time before they're in trouble, if they're not already in trouble. And then there's infrastructure issues. The three things to worry about are track, the condition of your track, your tunnels, and your bridges. Now, under the Federal Railroad Administration, track is regulated. And so there are federal inspectors and there are state inspectors. And I have pretty good data about the track and its conditions. I have folks who literally walk or ride the rails around the year and assessing them, looking for tie condition, steel condition, joint condition, everything. Things that are being regulated to see whether or not it's safe and in the condition it should be. But there's two main components, the classification, and there's 9 levels. The higher the number, the beefier the system and the faster you can go. And the lower the number, the worse condition, and the slower you go. In Oregon, what we prefer is for them to be at least class 2, because that's the minimum level that's still under the FRA regulations, et cetera, and you can go 25 miles an hour. But much of our short lines run at class 1, which is lower or accepted. They simply don't have the dollars to get it up to class 2, or they can, in their own prerogative, choose to run it as accepted. And you think, well, why would somebody want to do that? Well, you might have to run slower at 10 miles an hour, and you might be limited to how much hazardous material you can ship at any one time, but it's lower cost to maintain, and it's outside of most of the federal regulations. So, you know, it's just a little bit easier to keep going if you're on a shoestring budget to begin with. But it also means your track may be in very, very poor condition. Now, the other thing going on to page 3, you've heard about 286. Most of our rail in Oregon, about 80%, is able to handle the 286,000 GVW rail cars. That's the industry standard. And what we say in the industry is if you've got 110-pound, that's per yard, 110-pound rail or better, you're probably able to handle 286 just fine, although 133 or heavier is really, really what you want. But about 20% of our rail is not there. It ranges from 62 pounds per yard to 90, far below the 110 minimum you'd want to see out there. I mean, we've got some rail that's still out there from the 1879, 1880s. So pretty old rail. Certainly gotten your money's worth out of that rail. Upgrading the amount of track that we have left in Oregon that is not 286, it would be somewhere between 125 and 150 million. Takes somewhere between a quarter million, 300,000 per mile to upgrade it to the Class 2 186 standard, or 286 standard. Bridges and tunnels. Now, you all are familiar with highway bridges. Again, there's similarities between the modes. Highway bridges are aging, and aging infrastructure, OTA money, upgrading the bridges. Well, rail bridges also are aging. They were mostly built in the 40s and 50s. A lot of them were timber trestles, not steel or concrete. And what's on the chart that I've given you is only those bridges that are over 100 feet in length. I mean, there are literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bridges. Some may be something very, very tiny, but we counted the bridges that are over 100 feet in length, and that's what's on your chart. And tunnels, they also suffer from aging issues. The Cork tunnels are a perfect example of that. There are 69 railroad tunnels in Oregon, and 34 of them, over half, are on the short line system. And all but one were dug between 1883 and 1916. So almost every single one of them in the state's nearly 100 years old or over 100 years old. And they, too, have timber ribs inside of them, and timber in a wet climate and over time is going to decay and is going to start falling down, and it's structural as far as being able to hold that tunnel firm. Now, what's interesting is what was recently noted in a GAO report that Congress commissioned is there are no federal regulations under the Federal Railroad Administration, FRA, for tunnels and bridges. So track and hazardous material and signals and operating practice, all of that's regulated and have regulations about what it should look like and how it should be maintained, but railroad tunnels and bridges are not. So it's left to the railroads to look after and to make sure that they're safe and to make sure that they're kept up. Now, the other thing is, unlike the highway system, when we've had bridge issues and we've had to put weight restrictions or reroute trucks, there were detour or redundant routes to go on. With a rail system, there's very little redundancy left out there. As you've heard, much of it's been pulled up or never existed. And people aren't out there chewing up a lot of land building rail corridors anymore. What we've got is what we've got for the most part. With every right-of-way we have, you might have enough room to put a second track down, but nobody's chewing up land, like I said, to build a rail corridor. So they're an endangered species that we have to protect. And even if we lose a line, we need to try to keep that right-of-way intact, because you never know when a future generation is going to be able to put it back together and need it. Now, rail funding. You guys have talked about rail policy. There are laws in Oregon statute about the authority to acquire and run an operator railroad, a city or a county or state entity, et cetera, special district, things like that. There are laws on the books about that. So folks have recognized that. And there is a state rehabilitation railroad fund on the books, but no money's ever been put into it, to my knowledge. I've looked back through history. It looks like it got created with the idea, but then no funding mechanism. So where we really got a gap in policy is a funding mechanism. And there have been bits and pieces of it. In 91 and 93, the legislature did $2 million each time for short line rehab, understanding the needs. There was a couple of short lines that got into some real trouble, came for the e-board, and that sort of generated the interest. And in 2003, and in 2003, the legislature did a, or 05, excuse me, with Connect Oregon 1, did a $8 million industrial rail spur account. And that money was out there to build some rail spurs and to generate jobs in the carloads, et cetera. So there's been bits and pieces. And Congress, over time in here, you'll see, has come up and helped with about $50 million. But as you can see, if it would take $125 to $150 million to take the last 20% and get it up to Class 2 or to handle 286, we're a far cry away from that. And so I think funding is the primary issue, I think. We have a rail study that I'm just getting ready to launch. We just issued the RFP, or excuse me, awarded the RFP. And I have a director on board now to help me start putting the work products together and start pulling the pieces of that together. Which will do an assessment of the bridges and of the tunnels, because I know that's the biggest gap of information in our portfolio. I have good information about track. I don't have any information about bridges and tunnels to really share with you, other than how many there are, and I know how old they are, but not what their condition is. And also to pull together some funding mechanism ideas. You know, our counterparts to the North, Washington, have some fabulous programs that they've put together and are bringing in several hundred millions just for rail, because they've recognized the need for rail, and they've looked into, do they acquire, do they do a short line here or there, where do they need to invest. I mean, they're busy looking at the very same questions you're all grappling with, they're grappling with, but they've come up with some funding mechanisms. Now, what we'll all have to do with the study is come up with, looking across the country, what are different states doing, bring it to you, and then we'll need to see what would work here in Oregon. Or is there a change? Is it a constitutional change? Is it a law change? Is it something that just wouldn't work out here because it's population-based and it works great in New York but doesn't work so hot here in Oregon because you don't have the population to generate the same number of dollars? That's what I need to bring before you. Now, I want to take you and have you look at the chart just so we can look through at least the top line so you can see how to read this. So I'm at this page. I'm at page 4 of 7. And what I have here is, they're in alphabetical order. It's the railroad, Albany and Eastern. And looking straight across that line, it's miles of rail owned or leased, its gross revenue, its carloads in 2006, and its carloads per mile, how many tunnels, how many bridges over 100 feet, what class of track it is, the number of miles of rail that are less than 110 pound, whether or not they're handling 286 cars, because they may not really have their rail up to speed, but they're running very, very slow and very carefully and trying to still handle the carloads. And then just some comments that, of things that we knew, that my staff knew, or that we'd heard from the railroads about this particular one, whether or not they have the business and the wherewithal to make it. And when you'll go through here, if we had something about their branches, so when you look down at our Albany and Eastern, you'll see that they have a Mill City branch and a Santa Ann branch. Those two branches make up what Albany and Eastern is operating. Hmm. So we tried to break down the branches within the system. So if you look down at the next one, is Central Oregon and Pacific. That's the one that just shut down the middle one there, Coos Bay Branch. Coos Bay Branch is 137 miles. In 06, they did 5,845 carloads, which is 43 cars per mile average. So when you go back and look at that rating from the 93 pamphlet, you'll be able to see how well they are or aren't doing. And then there are some, like I said, some information about them. Because some of our rail lines, that 93 pamphlet was talking about if situations were normal, if it was a your basic railroad. Frankly, in Oregon, we've got some train that's a real challenge. Both the corp on the Coos Bay line and the Port of Tillamook Bay line are challenged with the terrain, the grade, steep grade, the curves, the weather. The terrain itself that it's built upon. So that's not exactly your normal situation, so they probably need even more carloads to try to have enough for both operations and maintenance. They're making it most of the time on operations, and one line within a system may help subsidize another, and that sometimes can be an ugly word inside the railroad business, the word subsidize. But frankly, within their system, they're doing okay. It's just this particular line needs help from this particular line over here within this, their own system. So... with that, Madam Chair, I would like to say, Representative Tomei asked about the Amtrak and the preference. I will tell you that they do have preference, and Mr. Barrows was correct. The problem is the freight rail is getting longer and longer, and there aren't enough long pullovers. You know, for vehicles on the road, you have those slow vehicle turnouts where the big motorhomes or something pull off every once in a while, letter rails go by. That's what's supposed to happen between freight and passenger, but the freight rails are so long, they don't always have the siding to fit in. So they might pull off, but they'd still stick out on both ends. It wouldn't do anybody any good. So the shorter passenger rail pull over. But I will tell you that we are investing $4.5 million in a siding down in Eugene. This is the last of the investment for the second passenger train that we added, and we negotiated with Union Pacific what sort of investments we'd need to make in Oregon to offset the impact of that second train. And this $4.5 million is the last piece of that. We are building a 16,000-foot siding just north of Eugene, which is nearly 3 miles long. And that will help tremendously to help have a spot for those freight rail trains to pull off onto so the passenger trains can keep going. So that's a huge piece of capacity being built just north of Eugene right now. So, and with that, Madam Chair, I will stop.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Tomei.
Oh, go ahead, Peter.
Representative,
do you have a question?
I'd be happy to wait for you, Representative. Oh, Kelly, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Tomei. When you mentioned the revenue sources of the state of Washington, as you were saying, you're going to do the report. I look forward to seeing the report. Mm-hmm. Can you just give me a little sneak preview? What's the state of Washington doing now to raise that amount of money?
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, I'd be happy to. Two things that they're doing. The first thing that they did a few years back was they implemented a surcharge on rental cars and dedicated it to rail. And that in itself is raising, I think, something like $180 million over a 10-year period or something. And that's pretty big. So it's not bonded debt. It's ongoing revenue. The second thing they did, they had sort of their version of OTIA, because they've got some bridge issues, too, on their road system, their highways. But they did a comprehensive transportation package that wasn't just road. It had rail pieces on it. And they did a fee on the weight of your vehicle, your passenger vehicles, as you register them. So you might pay for your stickers, but if you have a Volkswagen Beetle, it's less than your SUV. Now, in Oregon, right now, a fee that's related to motor vehicles goes off the highway fund. So that's why I'm saying I will bring the ideas to you, and you'll have to decide if it's worth, you know, trying to change the constitution for that particular fee. Not any of the existing fees, but for this one.
May I follow, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for that answer. And I'm just going to, I'm assuming that you are coordinating your efforts with the governor's work groups on the overall transportation plan for 2009?
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, yes, I am.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kelly, I think, I'm sure we've had this conversation in the past, but I'm assuming from all of this that the federal government is really not contributing much to our railroads. They may contribute to a highway fund, but they're not really contributing much to our railroad system.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, that's correct. There are funds for all of the other modes. There's transit funds, there's aviation funds, there's road funds. There is no railroad fund.
Follow up?
Yes.
Has that always been the case, Kelly?
Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, that's my understanding, because it's just the way it's evolved through the years. There are a few loan programs here and there, but nothing. There's no appropriations. There's no trust fund. There's no subsidy.
If I may,
yes, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. So I'm assuming, as many of us travel in other countries, you see a very robust rail lines, Europe, Asia, wherever one travels. So I'm assuming that their governments are helping build and maintain those rail lines. Would that be true?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, and the public is paying for it. They chose to heavily invest, and that's why in France the TVG train can go take you from Paris to Nice in about 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've chosen to do that and to run high-speed rail, because I get asked that quite a bit. What would it really take to run high-speed rail? It would take a lot of money, but you could do it. But in order to go over like 90 miles an hour, we run at about 79 max, to go over 90 miles an hour, you would need to separate all of the at-grade crossings, do some separate track and things like that in order to make it safe and to really have it be efficient and really be able to do it. You can get there, but you do have to pay for it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, question. I noticed that I'm new to the committee, obviously. The 2006, there was some $100 million awarded, and then another $100 million in 2007. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Bentz, yes, it's Connect Oregon. It's non-highway modes. Four modes are available to apply: air, marine, rail, and transit. And of the first $100 million, about $29 million of it ended up being awarded to short line projects.
And follow up. And how do you measure, or where are the reports that show the economic benefit of that $29 million?
Madam Chair and Representative Benz, it is in the application. They show there were some considerations listed in the legislation, the things that the legislature was looking for, whether or not it created jobs, whether or not it was reducing costs to transportation, cost to businesses, et cetera. In their applications, the applicants would document what they believe the benefits would be. And then in the agreements that we have entered into in order to distribute the money, there are milestones and measurements in that.
Last question. Mm-hmm. And so if I wanted to look at those, the achievement of those milestones, where would I look?
Madam Chair and Representative Bentz, most of those projects are still underway. A few of them have been completed, and I'd be happy to bring some information and give you an update on Connect Oregon 1.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity.
And with that, I want to thank everybody who came for the informational hearing, and I look forward to working with all of you as we head into 2009 and start talking about a transportation package. So thank you for coming. And I'm going to close the informational hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1079. And I am looking for Paul Romaine, who is probably waiting in the hall.
We'll get it.
And Lorna, if you want to come up with him. And Representative Dinkfelder, if she wants to come up too. Yes. I hope nobody takes a picture of me sitting next to Mr.
Oh, yeah.
You guys clash or something?
Oh, here. You want one for your book here?
So put it on my website.
Have the other, right? Would you mind switching?
I don't know how I get this recognition.
Mr. Romaine, do you want to kind of...
defend yourself.
I don't want to be rude to the representative, but we probably need a little explanation of what we're doing here. So you want to kind of give us the briefing?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. And the original reason why you're here... there are two reasons. One of them has to do with a fuel tax issue. The other one has to do with a product called ethanol. And they're both covered in Senate Bill 1079, the fuel tax issue. Very simply, we were trying to solve a problem about who's responsible for collection and payment of fuel tax. What happened was ODOT drafted a solution. It was put into Senate Bill 1079. We've found out that we need a couple of corrections to what is in 1079. Fortunately, we're going to have a chance to amend it tomorrow. So right now we have some A7 amendments which need to be slightly altered, but for tomorrow we'll have some other amendments for you. The bottom line is it clarifies that, in effect, the card issuer is the one who's responsible for collection of the tax. It just makes things easier for both the people who have the stations and for the state. There's no downside to it. It looks like everybody's fine with it, and ODOT is here to basically say the same thing, I assume. The second portion of the bill deals with a problem that came up after passage of the ethanol.
Do you want Senator Johnson up to talk about it?
I'm fine having Mr. Romaine explain.
All right.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Let's see. I'm preempting a representative and a senator. Yeah, that's really doing well for me long term.
we'll remember that.
The second portion of the bill deals with ethanol. And basically what we found after passage of the bill is that a number of constituencies came up and said, wait a second, this doesn't really work in some of the things that we do, mainly aircraft, watercraft, certain aircraft, not all aircraft. There's a certain number of airplanes out there where it will actually make them fall from the sky, which is something we really don't want to have happen. So the solution is to exempt from the ethanol mandate certain uses of the fuel, hoping that a market will develop because there will be sufficient amount of usage to actually develop a market that my clients, the distributors and retail accounts, will service. So we believe that the market will be there, but you're going to have to ask me next year if the market truly is there. But at least it gives us the opportunity to service these kinds of craft that really cannot use an ethanol mixture in their particular either plane or boat or tool or model car or whatever it is out there, racing car. I think that's basically the two bills or the two concepts in the one bill.
All right, thank you. And with that, well, maybe you can switch out with Senator Johnson and she can come up. But don't go too far. And
we'll do this together. Sure. Yeah. I'm State Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and pleased to be here with
State Senator Betsy Johnson.
And in the dash, is this the dash six that you have in front of you? This is, first of all, I want to thank the good senator for her leadership in pulling together this work group in such a quick time frame, because really we had all the players at the table that had expressed concern or that was involved with this issue. But I just wanted to step back and give the committee a little bit of background, just a reminder that the biofuels bill that passed last session, this was a bill that I'd worked on for 4 years. And it passed with strong bipartisan and bicameral support. And I just want to make it clear for the record that in the 4 years that we were working on this bill and the many, many hearings and testimony, we did not hear one email, call, testimony about this issue. So I do want to say that we were a little bit surprised that this came up. However, we were put together this work group so we could work through these issues and make sure to address it. And so we've had a lot of emails, as I know many of you have, why didn't this come up? Well, to be honest, nobody had brought it up. And I am not a pilot. I have a kayak that's non-motorized, so I don't put gas in my boat. And so it never came up as an issue. Now, we haven't had, fortunately, planes that have had problems. So this is, we're really taking a conservative approach here to make sure and protect consumers that this doesn't become a problem. So we researched what other states have done to address this. We found a model, the state of Minnesota, that had already passed a similar bill and similar exemptions. And I just wanted to say that this is truly a bipartisan, bicameral response. We had members of both parties and both houses, all different folks that weighed in. And I also want to thank your committee staff, Patrick, who spent quite a bit of time helping us draft this language. So what you have in front of you is, I think, a good compromise piece of legislation that provides an exemption. As you heard, we are hoping that the market will respond. We cannot dictate to the market that you have to produce this, you know, certain amount, but we think there's going to be enough demand there. And one of the things we do want to do is come back in a year and see how this is working. It's one of the advantages of having annual sessions or supplemental session. We can come back and check again and make sure that this is, that there aren't unintended consequences. And basically, that's what happened with the original biofuels bill. There was unintended consequences that we just were not aware of. So I appreciate the education that I've had, learning about the different types of fuels and what the potential impacts could be. And I also want to thank the senator for her leadership in this and making sure that all the issues, especially with the aircraft issues, were addressed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. And by way of getting the declaration of conflict out on the table quickly, my husband owns an airplane that is perhaps subject to this bill, and so I just want to get that out on the record. I really don't have much to add to what Representative Dingfelder has said. This was an issue of unintended consequences. There are a number of us in the legislature, including members of this committee, who are aviators and voters, and frankly, this just got past us all. As soon as the bill became law, there was a firestorm of constituent contacts. I want to acknowledge Representative Dingfelder and Senator Avakian, who were good enough to allow us to open up their bill. Senator Metzger on the Senate side, who added the first set of amendments. I carried the bill on the Senate side, acknowledging that the fixes on the Senate side were not adequately comprehensive to create a market. We pulled together this bipartisan bicameral work group, and with Patrick's inestimable help, were able to craft the language that is in front of you. I also want to acknowledge the help of the Department of Agriculture, Mr. Don Hefner from the Marine Board, and especially Dan Klem from the Department of Aviation, who worked really hard to try to find a solution. What we were very worried about were the unintended consequences of boating accidents or airplane accidents, or the chilling effect in the aviation community of having Oregon be seen as a place where aviators couldn't count on reliable fuel. Oregon is becoming an aviation mecca for kit-built planes. We have the largest kit-built manufacturer in the world here in Oregon, and a number of other aircraft that are being produced here that are in some cases ethanol intolerant, and I think that these amendments that you have before you will go a long ways towards alleviating the problem. As Mr. Romaine spoke to, and I want to emphasize again, this is not the panacea, but it is certainly a clear step in the right direction to make sure that we don't put aviators or mariners at risk. And so I commend these this amendment to your consideration. Above all, we don't want to damage Mr. Romaine's underlying bill, because he was enormously cooperative in helping us use his bill as a vehicle to get this fixed before you. So I commend the amendments for your thoughtful consideration. I hope you include them in the bill, and that we can provide this window of opportunity to continue to develop markets for marinas and airports that will allow folks using those kinds of fuels to get to them, particularly in rural Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these two?
Just a comment. I greatly appreciate, I don't know whether it's Patrick or the department, but the inclusion of a racing activity vehicle as defined in ORS 801-404. Greatly appreciate
it. I bet it is. Representative Benz.
Sure, a question for the Senator is, do you anticipate labeling difficulties or anything of that nature? I'm unfamiliar with the legislation, so it probably has already been addressed.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, we are particularly conscious of the need to protect the distributors and the wholesalers from falling into the liability stream. And I think we are attempting to add language that will make it quite clear that they are not selling aviation fuel, that if people choose to use fuel in aircraft engines, particularly that are tolerant to that kind of fuel, that they're making a conscious choice, but that the wholesalers and distributors are not selling aviation fuel. And so I think we still may have one other language adjustment prior to you seeing this bill in work session, but during our work group discussions, both Mr. Doherty on behalf of his clients and Mr. Romain on behalf of his clients were vigilant in assuring that they didn't assume a new mantle of liability heretofore not attached to them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to excuse myself and scamper back to Ways and Means, so thank you for allowing us to speak.
And, we do have Lorna with DMV, and do people have questions for Mr. Romain? Do we want to bring him back up? So he also needs an amendment, so we might need to, I don't know if we need to address that, or...
He did mention it, Madam Chair.
Okay,
I think he did.
All right. So, no questions for Mr. Romain, then you can just sit and listen. And Lorna.
I'm Lorna Young, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation Central Services Division, and I have provided you some written testimony. I would speak only to the original portion of the bill, which deals with a redefinition of what is a card lock that would allow us to more efficiently collect taxes that are owed or not owed on the sale of diesel fuel. So you've got my written testimony before you, and I know there are others that want to testify on this bill on the portion related to the ethanol. So if there's, I'd be happy to go into more detail or just let my written testimony stand unless you have any questions about the purpose of the underlying bill.
Thank you. Any questions?
We would like some consideration of the proposed A7 amendments that help clarify the card lock portion of the bill when you do go into work session on this bill tomorrow.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Yes, Representative Benz.
I need to declare a conflict. I think our firm does represent folks that do have card lock facilities. So, for purposes of the record.
Okay. So, and we'll ask you again probably tomorrow when we work session.
Please. That'd be good.
Okay. And with that, committee, we have a number of people, although it's not a terrible number, that I'm going to try to get through. So if you can stay until 5, that'd be great. But, you know, as long as you can stay, would be...
Welcome back.
Okay. All right. So we have two people in the audience who... Okay. Three people in the audience that came from more than 100 miles. So we'll start with Dennis Douglas. We'll bring up Bob and Mary Van Borsen. Did they get tired and not want to stick around? Oh, okay. Then Dean Billing. You want to come up with him?
Yeah, I know Dennis. I'll come up with him.
Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 1079A, Rev, whatever, I'm not sure. My name is Dennis Douglas, and I live at 2450 Northwest Wyeth Place in Bend, Oregon. By way of background, I am a retired physicist, a commercial pilot, a flight instructor, an amateur builder of aircraft. And for the last 4 months, I've learned more about ethanol, fuel distribution, and transportation systems and the legislative process than I ever wanted to know. I'm here today speaking to you on behalf of 2,491 pilots in Oregon that are members of the Experimental Aircraft Association, as well as hundreds or thousands of others that would be negatively impacted by the language in the current amendment. It's without a doubt that the language that's currently before you.
You know, we all have your presentation before us. If you can, I mean, it might be take less time if we just. Oh, are you going to get it?
It's ready
okay.
to go. The language that's currently in the bill, we all appreciate very much the work that the Senate and the House have done to accommodate these needs of particular engines. But just as the gasoline and alcohol don't mix applied to drinking and driving, it applies to many types of engines that are used in a variety of ways. Now, you've all read in the papers recently, New York Times articles and Science Magazine articles on the negative side of ethanol. It is not a particularly good product as we thought it was a couple years ago. There have been numerous editorials, at least in the Ben Bulletin. There have been three editorials. I know there's been articles in the Oregonian about it. And this slide sort of shows what ethanol does and does not do. Those little numbers up there, by the way, point to references at the back of your packet. I'm not going to go through all those. You thank me, I'm sure. but it's important that you understand that ethanol is not the end-all that we thought it were a couple years ago. Now, the problem is that The reason when this bill was heard before the Senate Transportation Committee, there was a language used, a mixed use of terms, that caused some alarm in me. Now, I know many of you understand how fuel is transported and delivered, but some of you may not. The particular concern occurred because the members of the committee used the term blended to refer to fuel that had ethanol in it. Later, a person came up and gave testimony from the Department of Agriculture, and she used the term blended to refer to how fuel is mixed at the pump. That is, that premium fuel and regular fuel are mixed together to get a mid-grade. Now, the misconception is that the ethanol is added at the local pump, the local thing, and that's not the case. The fact that is that ethanol is added at the terminal, which is a large upstream part of the fuel distribution system. And it's for that reason that the fuel that is delivered to the consumer is not going to be readily available without ethanol blending. Now, in the state of Oregon, there are 7 terminals that serve the entire state of Oregon. The 3 largest terminals are in Portland, Eugene, and in Boise, Idaho. There are 4 smaller terminals in Vancouver, Pasco, Washington, somewhere in Nevada that I couldn't get the name of, and in Chico, California. These 7 terminals, when this bill comes in, these 7 terminals will be the source of where the ethanol is put into the bill, into the gasoline. In this slide, it shows the chain of distribution of the fuel as it comes into Oregon. The terminal, take the Portland terminal as an example, they receive fuel from the Olympic pipeline that comes down from Seattle. They receive fuel from ships that come in up the Columbia. It's at the terminal, the Shell terminal, the Chevron terminals, and so on, where the gasoline goes in, where they add the Tecronite and their V-Powers and things like that to give them their brand names, their company specific. And it's at this point also in which ethanol is added. Now, the ethanol is added, and then a distributor buys that fuel. The distributor trucks his fuel to his area in a couple places down in Bend. One of them is Bend Oil. The distributor then sells that fuel to the retail outlets, to the cardlock stations and others. So in the case of a gas station, I've shown on this slide, typically gas stations have 3 tanks at their station. They have a diesel tank, a regular tank, and a premium tank. When someone goes in to buy mid-grade gasoline, they mix on a roughly 50-50 percentage premium fuel and regular fuel to get mid-grade. But you can see that if the ethanol is added at the terminal, then there's not going to be any way to get ethanol-free fuel to the local consumer, the local Joe who needs it for his chainsaw or for whatever. Now, the language in 1079, this actual language applied to the first version of 1079, it doesn't solve the problem of availability. And the terms of one representative, we blew it. In terms of a senator, it doesn't do squat. There have been changes made since that time that certainly improve the situation, but the problem is the market still isn't there. It's not going to generate this. There's not enough demand that the local dealers are going to take the expense of putting in the facilities necessary to handle this relatively small market. Now, the long term, I think, is to repeal the entire thing altogether. The short term, though, is to exempt premium. So, first of all, if you exempt premium, what are the consequences of that? Using the Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy statistics, show that for calendar year 2006, about 90% of the fuel that was sold in Oregon was regular grade, 2.6% was mid-grade, and 7.6% was premium. If you exempted premium, it would still mean that nearly 90% of the fuel sold would contain the 10% ethanol that's required, and 7.6% of the gasoline would contain no ethanol. If 1079 were amended to exempt premium, then 92.3% of the gas sold in Oregon would still have ethanol in it, but that 7.6% of the gasoline would contain no ethanol. By doing that, allowing that, it solves all of the problems of the concern of these constituencies that have come up and brought all these issues. Now, for every time, if you've developed a list, I'm sure that there are people with other lists that can add to that list of people that have been neglected in this thing. Now, what have other states done? There are currently, in the United States, there are 41 states that sell ethanol-blended fuel. There are three states that have mandated and implemented the ethanol requirement. Those states are Minnesota, Missouri, and Hawaii. Now, the previous witness up here testified that what was chosen was the Minnesota paradigm. The problem with the Minnesota paradigm is that it requires the local reseller to have an extra pump. And what the person must do then is show or authenticate his use for that, and he can draw that fuel. The fuel is actually provided separately, in other words. So the question is your local guy going to make the expense to put in the facilities necessary to handle this? And I submit that it's not. You've heard testimony, or the Senate heard testimony, of an airport operator at Lebanon who said he will put in a skid tank or something to carry ethanol-free premium. My airport in Bend, Oregon, the FBO has said that he will not. So in Bend, Oregon, we're pretty isolated out there, so we're not going to drive to Lebanon to get the fuel. There's other concerns as well. Now, Hawaii is the only state that implemented, by the way, all these other states effectively have, or literally or by de facto, have exempted premium gasoline. That is these three states. Now, Washington and Montana are about to do the same kind of thing that Oregon is planning. The problem is they're going to run into the same problems that you face right now. They don't know it yet, but they're going to face it. Now, Hawaii had this plan. They actually wrote the law, they implemented it and put it in place, but a year later, 2 years later, they exempted premium because of all the problems that they had with aircraft, boats, stationary engines, emergency generators that didn't run. Long term, they sit there, they can gather, the alcohol gathers water from the air, it's called quiescent is the term. And that problem then is those emergency generators didn't run. So my suggestion, my request to you is to take the simple wording of the Missouri ethanol law that has probably all the same language that the Oregon law has in it, but it has this simple provision. The following shall be exempt from the provisions of this section: aviation fuel and automotive gasoline used in aircraft and premium gasoline. That solves a huge number of issues. It solves all the problems that you're going to this, the cumbersomeness of all these detailed exemptions. So in summary, ethanol is not a good solution for the environment, and permitting it for certain applications is not a good solution because it's not going to be economical. Besides that, there are logistical issues. How are you going to authenticate that a particular user, I want 5 gallons or 20 gallons, how are you going to authenticate that that user is in fact deserving of that fuel? Does he really have an airplane? Does he really have a boat? Does he really have a chainsaw? By exempting premium, you eliminate that. The consequence of exempting premium is small, but there's a very big benefit. So the last point is, again, the request that you simply adopt the words from the Missouri law, which has worked, and it's going to be it's going to simplify all of your lives a lot more. That's the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Dean. Yeah, hi.
We have your testimony, so don't read it all.
No,
summarize it, please.
All right. Madam Chairman and legislators, I'm Dean Billing. I'm an aircraft owner that was affected by HB 2210. I'm an amateur radio operator. I'm concerned about public safety, and I'm a homeowner in a heavily wooded area in Sisters, Oregon. I'm testifying in an attempt to convince you that the best course of action for 1079 would be to delete Section 17 and 18 of HB 2210, the mandate. And I'm just going to go through some stuff that Mr. John Charles testified at the original hearings for HB 2210 that I think are very applicable to the idea of just not making it mandatory. It's been mentioned earlier, but it's very likely that ethanol has minimal environmental energy gains anyway. Back when he did this in 2007, this month Scientific American has a wonderful overview with all kinds of cool color graphics and has on this subject, which I am tempted to make copies for you, but it would have cost me about $88, and I didn't want to violate your ethics standards for gifts to legislatures. There was a lot of laughter over that. So I will just say there are 2 points here from the issue that are worth acknowledging, which it says, although politicians are aggressively pushing ethanol for homegrown corn from homegrown corn as a substitute for foreign oil, the conversion makes little energy sense. It requires copious amounts of fossil fuels. Secondly, studies show that producing ethanol from corn creates almost the same amount of greenhouse gases gasoline production does. Burning ethanol in vehicles offers little, if any, pollution reduction. Now, among the stat heads who study this, there is a raging debate about do we actually consume more energy in making ethanol than we get out the back end. And I'm not one of those people intimately in the debate, but I know that it's out there, and I think the best thing that you can do is stay out of it. Let the market actors risk private equity on this, and those who lose, they lose their own equity. Those who gain, they gain, and the rest of us taxpayers, we just, you know, sort of ride the wave. When you intervene, our tax money is likely to go down a rat hole somewhere. I think that still applies. Unfortunately, nobody asked him any questions, and they passed HB 2210. I'm asking you to do the honorable thing and repeal the mandate, Section 17 and 18. Now, if you don't do that, I want to make sure that everybody understands how insidious ethanol and gasoline are together. There are 4 main problems. Ethanol is a solvent. It produces 1/3 less energy than gasoline. It is completely denatured alcohol, 99%+ pure, which has its problems. And one of those problems is phase separation, and you need to understand those. I'll just summarize ethanol being a solvent. It causes a lot of problems in older cars, classic cars, any stationary engines, anything that you have an old tank. If you don't know the condition of that tank, ethanol will clean that tank out and try to send it to the engine. And even in fairly modern cars, it causes problems with fuel pumps in the tank, especially. So it's doubly a problem in small two-cycle engines. Mixing oil with gasoline, with ethanol, the ethanol defeats what the oil is trying to do. It's trying to lubricate the engine. The ethanol is trying to clean the engine out. It has 1/3 less power. This leads to problems in small two-cycle engines, especially. You have to make up that power somehow if you're using a chainsaw in a production environment. In your car, what happens is when you introduce E10, your computer will just compensate by adjusting the fuel flow to your fuel injectors, and it'll adjust your timing, and you'll probably lose 3%+ in mileage. With a carbureted engine, that's more troublesome, like a two-cycle engine. First off, the ethanol is going to lean out the mixture. You need to compensate for that. If you have the same problems in your gas tank, if it's an old tool, you're going to have the same problem there. The biggest problem that I've talked to for people who use chainsaws in a production environment is the loss of power. The only way to get that power back, and this is the same for motorcycles, Harley Davidsons, all the old motorcycles with carburetors, you need to rejet the carburetor, and you have to increase the fuel consumption by about 45%. The problem with that for chainsaws in public safety, specifically firefighters, is if they tune up their chainsaws to get the maximum performance out of them and rejet them, they can't go to another state to fight fires with those tools. They won't work very well. And by the same token, firefighters coming in to our state, their equipment won't work very well here. No other state has the non-exception for every type of gasoline. We're the only state that would try to implement that. You need to understand, I'll just let you read this section about the purity of ethanol that's used in fuel. It has to be 99.2% pure in order to combine into gasoline. If it isn't, it'll just sit on the bottom of the tank. And that's the problem. That purity ethanol will try to get the water back. And so if it's called phase separation. If it happens, what will happen is almost the entire amount of ethanol will separate out of your gasoline, whether it's in your car or in a stationary engine used in emergency services. That 10% of your fuel will sit at the bottom with the water. It's highly corrosive. This is what happened in Hawaii in emergency services engines. It's obviously really bad in a very humid or rainy environment. And it doesn't take very much. It takes about 3 teaspoons per gallon to cause phase separation. Phase separation is not reversible. Once it happens, that's it. You have to pump the stuff out of the tank. If you don't know it and it phase separates, then the stuff is sitting on the tank is corrosive, which could ruin your tank. And if you try to start the engine, if it's an emergency services engine, it either won't start because it's pumping ethanol and water, or if it does start, it may not run very long, because once this whole state goes to E10, they're not going to be mixing regular gasoline in to make E10. What they'll use is an 80 octane gasoline that's specifically made for making E10. And once phase separation happens, all you're going to be doing is pumping 80 octane. Your car's computer, a modern car, will shut down. An old car will just die. So in summary, let me state the best outcome for SB 1079 would be to have it strikes Section 17 and 18 of 2210. Short of that, I urge you to incorporate the language for exceptions from the Missouri mandatory E10 law and grant blanket exception for premium unleaded gasoline.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming all the way over here.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you, members of the committee.
John Cox and Richard Scott. And probably after these two, we're going to close down for the day. I think everybody else is available to come back tomorrow.
Yeah.
So thank you. Go ahead.
You want to go ahead, Richard?
I'm Richard Scott. I live at 25180 Springwater Road, Estacada. And the website showed the hearings tomorrow, so I didn't have everything as prepared as I'd like to. So I didn't know what some of the others were going to say. I don't want to take your time by duplicating what they have to say. So some of these remarks will be somewhat off the cuff, but I'd like to put more of a human face on this. I have an antique airplane I keep at Valley View Airport at Estacada. There are 20 hangars there. I know about 8 or 10 of the other pilots. Rob Breitbarth, Robin Brooks, Steve Miller, Dave Sweel, Bob Veeley, and myself, we all use car gas in our planes. For some, it's a money thing. Rob Breitbarth is an officer in Angel Flight. Angel Flight transports people who are sick for medical treatment at no cost to the patient. If you remember the lady who got lost in the mountains in northeastern Oregon last fall, when she came home, she was transported by Angel Flight at no cost to her. Rob tells me that Angel Flight is having trouble getting pilots to fly missions because of the high cost of fuel. Rob was using car gas in his plane on these missions. Now he has to go to 100 low lead because it's difficult to get the ethanol-free gasoline. In my own case, when I fly my plane about 10 hours on 100 low lead aviation gas, my spark plugs foul up. Now, this is an antique plane that was used to train pilots in World War II, and you start the plane by swinging the propeller by hand. When the spark plugs foul, the only way you can get the plane to actually start is to set the throttle wide open. And so the engine goes immediately to 2,000 RPM, and the engine should go to 700 or 600. So you can see a very severe safety hazard. So I am very dependent on car gas. Now, some people may tell you that there's a product out there that will allow me to use 100 low lead, and that's TCP. That product has existed for several years. However, it has been taken off the market because it is a hazardous chemical, hazardous for transportation. So quantities of TCP that are already out there, once they're used up, they won't be replaced. So there will be no option except either extensive maintenance, clean the spark plugs every 10 hours, or find car gas without ethanol. The Department of Aviation, as I understand it, is proposing an optional system where, if I understood Mr. Clem correctly, they will leave it up to the gas stations to decide whether to dedicate a premium tank to off-road and exempted vehicle use or keep that tank for automotive use. I see that as being very inefficient. Valley View Airport is 4 miles outside of Estacada. If the three gas stations in Estacada choose not to dedicate a tank to off-road uses, to exempted uses, then I go 17 miles to Sandy, 18 miles to Clackamas, 18 miles to Oregon City, or 18 miles to Molalla to try to find a station that doesn't have it. If premium doesn't get a blanket exemption, as Dennis Douglas suggested, people with lawnmowers, generators, and what have you will be looking all over, if they are aware, will be looking all over the place for a station that will provide the fuel that they need. I'd say that is very inefficient, and I think most people would be, if they are aware that they could get it, would be driving around from station to station saying, where can I get ethanol-free gas? And eventually they'll find one and maybe go back there the next time. And perhaps on the third trip they'll find that, oh, it wasn't working out at that gas station, and so now they don't carry exempt fuel. There was mention of putting in a separate tank to carry the exempt gas. That's not very not very realistic. I called Ace Tank of Equipment in Seattle last week. They are a major provider of tanks for gas stations, and I was quoted $70,000 to install a tank. When you think about how dispersed we are, most pilots live in rural areas or on the edges of major metropolitan areas. We don't have a spot where we all go to buy gas. Rob Breitbarth lives halfway between Estacada and Oregon City. Robin Brooks lives near Clackamas. Steve Miller lives in Gresham. these sales would be so dispersed that it's very unlikely that very many gas stations will opt to dedicate one of their three tanks to the exempt fuel. I'm sure I've forgotten a bunch of things I wanted to say. You've all heard from me by email, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Cox. I reside at 4788 Red Wing Way in Lake Oswego, and I'm here today as the Legislative Affairs Vice President for the Oregon Pilots Association. Our current president, former Representative Joe Smith, and our past president, Dave Martin, have worked both with Director Klein and Senator Johnson, members of the committee, to try to work out, I guess, what you'd call a compromise. I've felt the glaring heat of the light being legislative affairs for the last 6 years. How could a bill reach law in Oregon without my knowing about it? And it's the same answer that the EAA and the Experimental Aircraft Association has had to deal with. We currently have had no search engines that could have found any word in the bill that would have tripped our knowledge. It was kind of unusual. So that's how it happened. And it's a critical point for this committee to consider that the FAA mandates aircraft cannot have any form of ethanol in them. So by the particular language that was in the original bill, it would exempt a large percentage of the aircraft, not just based in Oregon, as this gentleman's mentioned, but it's the aircraft that transverse our state and visit and bring economic dollars into the state. And it's certainly those industries that have hired people here in the state that create those type of aircraft, as was referenced by Mr. Dixon earlier. The position of the Oregon Pilots Association is acknowledging that ethanol cannot be present in aircraft fuel will force all forms of aircraft only to buy avgas. That's a buzzword we could have tracked. And there are aircraft that have used a buzzword that we used to use called MOGAS, motor gasoline, which I believed was the intent of this bill. But it was all-encompassing, and as had been mentioned in earlier testimony, other states that have tried this have acknowledged that aircraft must have ethanol-free fuel. And for those aircraft that have used MOGAS under what's called an STC, which is a special FAA document, they need a source. And I have to agree that it's going to be market-driven. I don't know that people will put the infrastructure in, so those pilots that visit would expect to find it somewhere. And in the next year, we're going to find out if that's possible. But the Oregon Pilots Association believes that this current Amendment 6 is our best hope for trying to protect those aircraft and the pilots that are flying them to cross into the state and leave from the state using gasoline-based products, hopefully that are devoid of ethanol. And we hope that you can find the fuel source that will make for safe skies. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions here? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. And with that, I think we are going to close the public hearing today, and we'll get everybody else up tomorrow.
There you go. Hey, that's a good way to separate it.
That's right.